Good morning. Please turn in your Bibles to Matthew chapter 7. And as you're turning to Matthew 7, I would invite all of you to participate in an opening exercise. Maybe even beg you to do this. A lot of times preachers start, I'd like you to do something, think about something, write something down, and maybe you do it, maybe you don't. I would really love it if you would engage in this opening exercise. What I would like you to do, if you've got something to write on, something to write with, a pen, a piece of paper, maybe markings, or if you don't have pen and paper, take out your smartphone, open the notes app, something you can use to make some notes. If absolutely you don't have pen and paper, you don't have anything you can type on to make some notes, then use the mental canvas of your mind to do this exercise as best you can. I really, 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 really would appreciate it if you would give me the benefit of the doubt and why I'm asking you to do this at the beginning and see where it goes. And the exercise is this. The first thing I would like you to do is think of someone who offends or bothers you. For some of you, it may not be that difficult. They may be top of mind. You might call them your enemy or your adversary. Could be an irritant, could be your ex, who's a little bit of all those things. You've got this person in mind who bothers you. They do things that bother you. Maybe it's someone you know personally, maybe it's someone you see on the TV all the time. Doesn't really matter, but you know about this person enough to know why it is you don't like them. You don't like them and you don't like being around them. And if you've never been around them, you wouldn't want to be around them. This is a particularly offensive person to you, a bothersome person. Do you have that person in mind? You do, and you've probably had that person in mind before, and you've been able to contemplate all their different flaws, their defective character traits, their sins, because they're so obvious. And you have that person in mind, and you have a list in your head already of all the things that they do wrong, all the things that are wrong with them. And second part of the exercise is, I would like you to begin listing all the characteristics and behaviors about this person that offend or bother you. You can take as much time as you would like during this whole teaching to continue to build your list. You've got the person in mind. Maybe don't write their name down because somebody might look over your shoulder and it turns out you're writing about them. Don't do that. But begin to make this list of all the flaws, the sins, the behaviors that drive you crazy when you think of this person, all the things they do. And as you're beginning to construct that list, let me tell you a story. Sometimes as a parent, you knock it out of the park. You come up with an idea and it works so well. You're so proud of yourself. You're like, I really am figuring out this parenting thing. And then there are other times where instead of knocking it out of the park, you strike out. I want to tell you about one of my big strikeouts here recently. My youngest son, Elijah, is a basketball player. I love to go watch him play basketball. It's been a joy watching him improve over the last several years. Didn't make the seventh grade team, made the eighth grade team, made the freshman team, plays JV now. And it's a lot of fun to go and watch him play. And he and I talk a lot about how he plays and how he can improve and what he can do better. And not long ago, I sat down, was beginning to watch one of his games, and I thought, I really want to give him detailed feedback. And a lot of times, I think of these things, I see it in the middle of the game, and you need to work on this, and you could be doing this better, but then I forget about it by the time the game's over, or if they win the game, the feelings are so positive, you don't really want to be so negative. I thought, here's what I'm going to do. I got out my phone, and I know that he always takes his phone and puts it in his backpack before every game, so he doesn't have access to his phone during the game. Of course not. And what I did as the game went on, I'm there with my phone, and every time I saw him do something that I noted, I sent him a text to his phone. Now, it wasn't all bad stuff. Some of it was positive stuff, but there was a lot of negative stuff as well. And I was in texting mode, so I was not writing these long feedback sandwiches, you know, where you put something negative inside something positive. The text did not say, my darling Elijah, it's such a joy to be your father. But you need to block out your man because he just scored on you. No, it was not that kind of text. It was block out your man. You just gave up 2 points. Hustle down the court. Hold your follow through. Sprint back to the huddle at a timeout. Watch that body language. Yeah, that was a good shot. Good rebound. But you could be doing it. And it was this stream of, hey, you got some things to work on, son. So you can imagine what it was like for him. After the game, pulls his phone out of his backpack and it blows up with this stream of negative texts from his so-called loving father. He was furious. He's like, do you have any idea what it's like to have someone text you nothing but negativity? I was like, no, son, no one's ever done that to me before. Did not go well. Did not have the impact that I hoped it would. And make several observations what I learned from that experience. The first is, it brought an end to our conversation that day. He was not interested in hearing anything else I had to say about his basketball game. He didn't say, Dad, tell me more. Can we drill down on this feedback? Give me some specifics. He was just done. Didn't want to hear anything else. So it chilled our conversation. It chilled our relationship for the day. It also, the second observation is, because of the way I did it, he didn't get better. He legitimately, you legitimately had some things you needed to work on. But the way I said it got in the way of what I was trying to say and what he needed to hear. So I missed an opportunity to help him get better because I blew it with so much negative, critical feedback. Third observation, I realized, oh, wait, you are such a hypocrite. Because you just did to your son the very thing you criticize and judge, sometimes condemn other Christians for in the way they interact with others, especially those who are outside the Christian faith. As research has shown us that one of the factors outsiders to Christianity who have a negative impression of contemporary Christianity in our society, one of the reasons they have such a negative view of Christianity, organized Christianity, and Christians is because they perceive us to be negative, critical, and hyper-judgmental. One young woman named Maya told her story to researchers from the Barna Group years ago for the book Unchristian. And it was a story about what happened when one of her friends became a Christian. And this is what she said. She said, before my friend became a Christian, you could talk to him. It was normal. He became a Christian after he met a girl and then through her got converted. But after the conversion, you couldn't talk to him anymore. Every conversation was about condemning something about my lifestyle. All he did was keep telling me all the things I was doing wrong. I shouldn't be smoking. I shouldn't be drinking. He didn't like the way I dressed or the music I listened to. And I was mad at the church. She wasn't mad at him. She was mad at the church for turning him into this kind of very negative person. You ask why I don't go to church, Maya says. Why would I want to become a negative person like most Christians are? That's why. The world is negative enough without the church making me more negative. I saw what it did to someone very close to me, and I don't want to become like that. Now, what she says is not true of all Christians and not true of all people who become Christians, but that's her story and that's her perspective, and it's good for us to listen to it. Our critical judgmentalism can ruin our influence with outsiders, those who are not interested in Christianity or following Jesus because of the negativity they see from Christians. It can also destroy relationships with insiders, with those who are a part of the church. Again, research indicates that those who grow up going to church and then at some point give up on church, give up on organized Christianity, this is especially true of young Christians. One of the reasons they say they just finally give up on church, not Jesus, but church, is because they grow tired of the judgy, nitpicky, hyper and hypocritical behavior they experience from some of their fellow Christians. As one ex-church-going Christian says, the church I grew up in, the Christians ate their young. And I just decided I didn't want to be a part of it anymore. So hypercritical and hypocritical judgmentalism can do damage both inside and outside the church. And Jesus anticipates this in the Sermon on the Mount when he gives this teaching to his disciples in Matthew chapter 7. He says, Do not judge, or you too will be judged. For in the same way you judge others, you will be judged. And with the measure you use, it will be measured to you. Why do you look at the speck of sawdust in a brother's eye and pay no attention to the plank in your own eye? How can you say to your brother, let me take the speck from your eye, when all the time there is a plank in your own eye? You hypocrite. First, take the plank from your own eye, then you will see clearly to remove the speck from your brother's eye. Do not give dogs what is sacred, and do not throw your pearls to pigs. If you do, they may trample them under their feet and then turn and tear you to pieces. The word of the Lord. If you were to ask those who say they have a negative impression of Christianity, outsiders who maybe would say they like Jesus but they don't really like the church, if you were to ask them to list some of their favorite teachings from Jesus, you say you like Jesus so much, well, why do you like him? What did he say that you like? If you were to ask them to list their favorite teachings, I would bet big money that this teaching would be near the top of the list. Maybe it's number one. Because outsiders love it when Jesus says, do not judge. What they think they hear Jesus saying when he says this is they think he's saying, do not evaluate or assess or critique or judge anyone else's behavior. What they think they hear him saying to his disciples is, hey, you want to follow me? Here's the deal. Mind your own business. Live and let live. Stay in your lane, bro. What they think they hear Jesus saying is the opposite of what they have experienced from so many of their Christian family and friends. You say, why do I like Jesus? He says, don't judge. Leave people alone. Why do I not like his followers as much? Because they do the opposite. But when Jesus says, do not judge, is he really saying leave people alone? Mind your own business. Is that really what he's getting at? Don't make assessments or evaluations of what other people are doing. Really? Because if this is what Jesus is teaching, this is one instance where Jesus does not practice what he preaches. Because we see him throughout the Gospels constantly making evaluations and assessments and giving feedback about the way other people are behaving, and not just their behavior, their attitudes and their motives. He says some harsh things to the Pharisees and other religious leaders. We say, yeah, he's the Son of God, though. He's qualified to say those kind of things. We're not. Fair enough. But just a few verses later in Matthew chapter 7, Jesus tells his disciples, you may have to make some judgments about teachers or prophets. That there will be false prophets, there will be true prophets, there will be good prophets come to you. And you can judge them by the fruit of their life. So by their fruit, you will recognize them. And Jesus says, you will have to make some distinctions. You will have to make some assessments. Not all teachers are good. Not all teachers are telling the truth. You invite some of them in and you send some of them on down the road. You have to make these judgments. Later on in Matthew 18, he will tell his disciples, here's how you go and confront someone else who has hurt you. Here's how you bring up someone's fault. And he tells us how to do it in such a way so that hopefully they'll listen, they'll repent, we'll win them over, restore a relationship, but they'll also change their behavior. So much for live and let live. The whole Sermon on the Mount is built upon this idea that there is a greater kind of righteousness. There's a deeper kind of righteousness than that which is taught by Pharisees and the teachers of the law. And Jesus wants us to know the difference. There's a good and a bad way to live. There's a right and a wrong way to live. And maybe that kind of absolute black and white language bothers you, so just put it on a continuum. There are gooder and badder ways to live. There are righter and wronger ways to live. Some things are black and white. There's some gray area for some things. It's good, it's bad. It's gooder, it's badder. And Jesus wants his disciples to be able to tell the difference, both in their lives and in the lives of others. So the first critical distinction we have to make when we wrestle with this teaching from Jesus, where he says, do not judge, is we have to understand that the word we use in English, judge, and the word in the original language behind it, krinos, they have a range of meanings. They don't just mean one thing. To judge means to assess or evaluate or critique, to offer feedback, to give an opinion even, to share a perspective. But it can also mean to render a verdict, either positive or negative. It's what judges do. They decide for some and against others, depending on the law or depending on the evidence. It's to offer a verdict, but it can also mean to condemn. To judge can mean condemn, as in declare someone worthy of punishment or destruction. You condemn a house, what are you doing? You're saying it no longer lives up to its purpose as a structure. It needs to be wiped off the face of the earth. It is no longer useful or productive or helpful. I condemn it. Get rid of it. I judge it. So when Jesus says, do not judge, he is not saying, do not assess or evaluate or offer feedback or give a perspective. He's saying, do not condemn. Do not judge others harshly or unfairly. You too will be condemned or judged harshly or unfairly. There is a place, a time, for assessing and evaluating and offering constructive, helpful feedback. We need to do that to exist in community as human beings. Just try to run a household or a company or coach a team or do anything else that requires constant improvement without assessing and evaluating and offering feedback. Society cannot exist. Civilization cannot keep moving forward if we're not speaking into each other's lives and explaining, hey, here, when you do this, it does this, and that makes it harder for the rest of us, and we all have got to figure out how to live together, and to do that, we got to communicate, and you share your perspective, I'll share mine, but some of us have to recognize we're doing things that are making things hard on other people. That is necessary to evaluate and assess and offer feedback. That's one thing. It's another thing, though, to stand in judgment of another human being, to condemn, to pass final judgment on another human being. That's unacceptable. So only God is qualified to do that. Only God can pass the final judgment on a human life. Only God knows where a person really belongs, in what category, saved or lost, inside or outside. Only God knows that. Because only God sees and knows what we do in secret. Only God knows the secrets of the heart. Only God can judge our motives. Only God knows the big picture and can see the real why behind the what it is we're doing. And who are we to take the place of God? To condemn another human being is to assume we have the same view of the world as God does. Jesus' little brother James wrote a little letter that ends up near the end of the New Testament. And in James chapter 4, James offers some extended commentary on this teaching from his older brother. In James chapter 4, verse 11, he says, "Brothers and sisters, do not slander one another. Is anyone who speaks against a brother or sister or judges them, condemns them, speaks against the law and judges it." Now, law here, James has already defined law. It's not the law of Moses, it's the law of love. Love your neighbor as you love yourself. And to speak out and judge and condemn others is to speak out against the law that says love your neighbor. Don't hate your neighbor, love your neighbor. Because when you judge the law of love, you're not keeping it, but you're sitting in judgment on it. There is only one lawgiver and judge, the one who is able to save and destroy, condemn. But you, who are you to judge your neighbor? And to communicate the deadly seriousness of condemning others, believing we have a God's eye view of their life, Jesus says, What if you were to be judged the way you judge others? For in the way you judge, you will be judged. The measure, the standard, the criteria you use to categorize and negate and exclude others, that same criteria can be used against you. What's that like? How does that feel? A couple of weeks after I sent Elijah that stream of negative texts, finished my sermon, stepped off the stage, walked to the back of the room, pulled out my phone. And it blew up with text messages from my so-called loving son. And he had taken the liberty during my sermon to point out everything that could have been better and texted it to me in real time. Hey, Dad, that joke about the dog wasn't funny. You have a hair standing up on top of your head. Very distracting. You slurred a word. Did you forget your place? This is running on a bit long. Wrap it up, Dad. Wrap it up. And I thought, this is horrible. And I apologized to him again. I am so sorry, because what if we are judged the way we judge others? It's one of the scariest teachings that comes out of the teachings of Christ, or the scariest question that comes out of the teachings of Christ. And he does it multiple times, so it's not an accident, and it's really hard to misinterpret what he's doing here. What if God treated you the way you treat other people? What if God treated you the way you treat your enemies? What if God was as quick or as slow to forgive you when you do wrong as you are slow to forgive those who do wrong against you? What if God were to grind you down the way you grind down those whose way of life offends or bothers you, who can never live up to your lofty criteria? What if God were to treat you the way you treat other people, especially those you have a problem with? Jesus breaks the tension of this heavy moment that he creates in his teaching then by telling a joke. And it really is a joke. The bit about, why do you look at the speck of sawdust in someone else's eye and pay no attention to the plank or the log or the beam in your own eye? It's a joke. It's meant to be absurd and ridiculous. It would have delighted his original audience, the imagery of it. It packed a punch, but it would have definitely gotten their attention because it's like a scene from The Three Stooges. Taylor, I think I see a speck in your eye. May I come closer? Can I look at it? Let me see. You need eye surgery. Let me help you with, all right. Oh, you've got a speck too. And you see how ridiculous it is? It says, how can you pay attention to the speck in someone else's eye when you have a log sticking out of your eye? And when you turn around quick, people have to duck. Jesus says, when we focus on the sins, the flaws, the character defects in other people, and pay no attention to our own sins and flaws and character defects, he says it's not just hypercritical, it's hypocritical. He says, you hypocrite. How dare you do that? Hypocrite is one of his favorite descriptions for the Pharisees and the teachers of the law. Which probably means he's yet again warning us, don't be like them. So what they do is they judge and condemn and exclude those who do not agree with their interpretation of the law, who do not conform to their way of life. They just write people off. Meanwhile, their hearts, Jesus says, are still hard and they are miles away from the heart of God. Don't be like them, he says. Now, in saying we have this log in our eye, he's not saying our sin is bigger or worse than their sin. We all have a speck of sawdust in our eye. We all have something in our eye. None of us are perfect. The log in our eye is not just our particular sin. The log in our eye is self-righteous pride. that would make us think that we are qualified to point out the specks in other people's eyes while paying no attention to what's going on in our eye. And it's that self-righteous pride that grows a speck into a log so that we are now blind to our own weaknesses and incapable of helping others with theirs. Because I can't get close enough to help if I keep poking you with my self-righteousness. So once again, as he has done throughout the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus calls us, rather than judging or condemning others for their behavior, first, as his disciples, look inward and evaluate yourself according to the standard Jesus gives in the Sermon on the Mount, the greater kind of righteousness. Start with your own heart, not with what's wrong with the world. And so, what does that mean? Before we condemn others for their violent ways, we must first address the anger in our hearts, out of which flows derisive insults that we use to write off and categorize and insult others with whom we don't agree. Before we condemn others for their sexually immoral and promiscuous lifestyles, we must first address the lustful thoughts and desires that take up root in our hearts and minds, and the prevalent infidelity or divorce that can happen in Christian marriages. Let's not judge them. Let's address what's going on in our own eyes. Before we judge others for lacking integrity, for being liars, Jesus says, first address your own penchant for creatively using language to dance around the truth and never really say what you mean. When Jesus says, focus on the plank in your own eye, he's not saying, focus on the plank and ignore the speck in their eye. He's not saying, mind your own business, live and let live. What he is saying is when you focus on the plank in your own eye, and the better you see your own shortcomings, the more self-aware you are about your own weaknesses and sins, the deeper you sink into the grace of God who loves you and forgives you in spite of your shortcomings, the more surgery God does on your heart, the clearer your vision, and the more capable and qualified you are to help others with the speck in their eye. But it's not from a posture of over and against or just over someone, condemning in some kind of arrogant way. It's not over and against, it's coming alongside, and we walk side by side with one another, because we're fellow travelers on the same road, and we all have specks in our eyes, and we all need eye surgery. Maybe one of the best ways to gain credibility and have the opportunity to influence others so that we could help them with the speck in their eye is to first humbly ask them to help us with the speck in our eye. And we do it as we walk together, as we work together, helping one another grow in Christ-likeness, not judging or condemning, but coming alongside to say, you help me and I'll help you because we need each other. Now, not everyone is going to be interested in this. Not everyone's going to want to walk with us or work with us. Not everyone is interested in letting us help them with the speck in their eye, and they don't really want to help us with the speck in our eye. We still have to make some judgments and some distinctions. We still have to know who we can help and how best to help and how we need to be helped. And I think this is a part of what Jesus means in the proverb about don't give dogs what is sacred, don't throw your pearls to pigs. We'll talk more about that next week. But it requires some wisdom to know how and when. But for now, let's come back to that opening exercise. Remember that one? You thought of someone? You listed some of their offensive behaviors. Here's the third piece to the exercise. Now what I would like you to do, circle or underline or put an X or a check next to all the characteristics you listed that are also true of you. All those things you listed about that person that drives you crazy, that in a moment of self-reflection you say, you know what, That's me too. I do the very same thing. Psychologists call these projections. We take something within ourselves and we project it onto someone else and even magnify it and fixate on them. I want to fix them either because I'm consciously or subconsciously hating certain aspects about myself. And so the thing that drives me crazy about you, it turns out that is the same thing that's driving all of you crazy about me. I'm just not addressing it. I would much rather talk about the speck in your eye than deal with the plank in mine. So here's your homework for today. Turn these projections into projects. Take these projections and let them become projects where you, with the help of God, turn that energy around, that energy you use to judge and dislike and condemn people, specific groups of people even, turn that around and focus it on yourself, and with God's help, begin to address some of the sins, the flaws, the defects that you diagnosed in yourself by first diagnosing them in others. And then as God begins to change your heart, notice how it clears up your vision. Notice how it changes the way you see the world, the way you see others. Notice how it changes the way you assess and evaluate and judge and address and even offer to help someone who needs some help. Notice how God's heart surgery is also eye surgery. It changes how we see each other. Let's take that scary question and turn it around into something more positive and hopeful. Instead of what if God treats you the way you treat other people, what if instead we treat other people the way God is treating us? What if when we open our hearts to God in humility and we experience grace and kindness and love and mercy, what if we then extend that to one another? We're treating other people the way God is treating us. That's not scary. That's beautiful. And that is the kind of beauty that can change the world. May it be so of us.